I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more remarkable memoirs this season, one of the highly anticipated books of the fall, is Dreaming Sally, a true story of first love, sudden death, and long shadows, by the author James Fitzgerald, who joins me now. In 1968, 50 years ago this past summer, Fitzgerald was part of a group of young high school graduates off to Europe for a tour. The Odyssey was the outfit that brought the scions of wealthy and or prominent families from Toronto to the continent. Fitzgerald, the son of a well-heeled Toronto doctor, whose father was also the same, is 18 years old and feeling lucky when a young girl he's had a crush on is in the same traveling party. Sally, 18, has a boyfriend in Toronto, an older fellow by a couple of years, that warns her not to go to Europe. He tells her she will die. The boyfriend in Toronto is George Orr, who would later go on to become a noted journalist and educator, someone who's been on this program many times before, who's a good friend of mine. Even though they're separated by the Atlantic, George and Sally maintain a correspondence, a lot of which is in this book. You see young love, obsession, as well as the making of promises unfulfilled. I'll get James to tell us what happened about Sally's life that was cut short, his affection for her, all the while she had a beau in Canada. Her death shapes both James and George's lives in uniquely fascinating, even fantastic ways. The exploration of the pressures of parents, the society in which these two guys grew up in, and how they rebelled as they came of age in 1968 make for such a compelling book. James Fitzgerald is the award-winning author of Old Boys, The Powerful Legacy of Upper Canada College, and What Disturbs Our Blood, A Son's Quest to Redeem the Past, which received the 2010 Writers' Trust Nonfiction Prize. Visit jamesfitzgerald.ca for more information. I intend to have George on this program shortly. And on Tuesday, the 20th of November, I'll be speaking with James and George at an event celebrating the book at Massey Books here in Vancouver. The event is at 7 p.m. and is free. This book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, James Fitzgerald. Mr. Fitzgerald, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
By the way, why is the G in your last name capitalized?
The family changed that in the 19th century. It's, you know, the number of people that insist on changing it to lowercase, it does irk me.
It does?
Cutting me down to size. I mean, it's like any other, like, you know, Sir John A. Macdonald, you know, capital M or small m, whatever, you know. It's all, but I noticed that Fitzgerald, for some reason, people have a hard time accepting the capital G, but that's the way we spelled it.
Yeah. So I read your book out of interest because one of the main characters is a good friend of mine, someone who, in this part of the world, has a reputation for his work in journalism and education, not to mention his brief foray into politics recently.
Yeah.
In a way, your book has been a great way to know George because he's a very different person than he was in the time that you write about him.
Yeah.
When did you feel that there was a book here, not just about him, of course, because it's also your story and it's obviously the story of Sally?
Yes. Yeah, it's sort of two autobiographies and a biography crammed together. But yeah, it's a long and strange saga, but I see Dreaming Sally as a culmination of a thematic trilogy. My first two books, Old Boys and What Disturbed Our Blood, really deal with the same themes, and the Sally book is kind of a culmination of that. And I didn't know, there would be no book unless George had not told me 30 years after the fact about this uncanny dream he had about his girlfriend Sally, that she was going to die in the summer of 1968, and that he believed the dream, and he told her not to go to Europe, you're going to die. This is what's sort of extraordinary about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that I meet her on the trip, and I'm falling in love with her, and I'm in a romantic triangle with her, with George and Sally. And then, uncannily, 2 weeks before the trip ends in August 68, he can't bear the pressure anymore. He's convinced she is going to die literally and metaphorically, and either lose her to me or die physically. And he fires off this telegram to her in Germany, will you marry me? And she says yes, and I burst into tears because I was devastated.
Uh-huh.
And then uncannily, she's killed in a freak accident hours later. So it's right out of, you know, the myth of Orpheus.
Yeah.
Very powerful. So that obviously the book explores how that affected us both, but I don't think I would have written the book just because I didn't know about the dream.
Yeah.
He didn't tell me the dream until 1998, on the 30th anniversary of our trip. Our trip, people, we met every 10 years because it's sort of like the big chill. Sally's was sort of the glue that kept us together. It was such a trauma for us. And she, didn't haunt us. She haunted George and me, I think, but more than anyone. But she, that's when he told me the dream over the phone from Vancouver in 98. And I was writing my family memoir at the time, and I sort of realized, oh, that's the seed of a third book, if we can bear it, you know, if and certainly if he gives me his permission, which he, 10 years later, he did.
Yeah, and so the book is told by with your writing, and interestingly enough, with his letters to her, and her letters back to him.
They're love letters from the summer of 68. That's right. It's been an ongoing thing because... As both of us being journalists and both of us having uncannily similar backgrounds, actually, and, you know, at one level as journalists, of course, it's an irresistible story, isn't it?
Right.
But on another level, it's highly irresistible because of what it demands of us, demanded of us, and it still does emotionally as men, and what we were prepared to dig down into there. All kinds of issues, of course, come out of it beyond Sally, you know, family and school and work and all the great themes are all there, and trauma and pain and joy, all kinds of things are all there. And so that was the question. And as my last book was coming to publication, I thought, well, I've got nothing to lose but ask George, this is in 2010, are you up to do this together? And of course I wouldn't dream of doing it without your permission. It's such a powerful story. His first two marriages collapsed under the weight of Sally's ghost, and I wouldn't want to inflict this on you. The idea is that a book would be, ideally, would be therapeutic, but there's always a risk that it can, in fact, re-traumatize. Because he went to the West Coast, really, to reinvent himself and put that all behind him and redefine himself, which he did magnificently. So you can understand his ambivalence. Why here's this guy from Toronto showing up and saying, you know, are you willing to go back into the past and unearth all of this? And he was thrown into intense ambivalence, and I can understand why.
Yeah, there's a moment in the book where I guess you ask him some very serious and very important questions, which is interesting because you also don't tell us what his answers are, but you tell us his response the next day where he emails you and he says, you took me to some very dark places in my life, but he appreciates it. I think that's what he said.
That's right, and that was in 1998 when he told me the dream, and then the next day he emailed me, and that was that's exactly right. That gave me an opening. I thought, that's a quite remarkable response. You know, I thank you for taking him into dark places that he's been trying to avoid. So I realized that's not something everyone would say. Some people would say, you took me to a dark place, and please go away.
Right. You know? So you met Sally first, is that right? You were kids?
That's right. Yeah. As a child up at Lake Simcoe north of Toronto when I was five. And then I just saw her sporadically. And then I sort of, she was actually the first girl I had erotic feelings for when I was about 11, hitting puberty up at the lake. I remember seeing her in her bathing suit. And before that, we had been like, she was like a tomboy, and we were just horsing around in the sandbar. And then that was sort of this electric moment of revelation. And that was in the summer of 62, and then I didn't see her for six summers. And being at an all-boys school like George, girls were a foreign species, and this is why she was such a charged figure for us. And so here she is miraculously appearing in 1968 on this student tour of Europe, 13 girls and 13 boys traveling in Volkswagen minibuses, and I, of course, gravitate to her immediately because I had always remembered her. Then she, of course, in the first few days of the trip, is talking about nothing but George and how she's going to marry him one day. But as the trip grew on, it was 1968, and the romance of Europe and sex, drugs, and rock and roll and that music, it was intoxicating, and we became inseparable after the first week, I'd say. It was an 8-week trip. And so you can imagine the triangulated tension there, because I was aware of George, and... Sally did not talk about me in her letters to George. But his radar being so sensitive, he knew that with something that she was hiding me. We, as they say in teenage parlance, we were not going all the way.
Right.
I was this 17-year-old virgin and enamored of her, and at the same time, very respectful of the power of what the fantasy I was stoking. I think if I look back and I was like, wow, this fantasy that I might actually steal her from George.
Yeah. And so you and Sally were the same age. George is a little older.
That was the other part of
yeah.
it. He was 3 years older, which in those days, of course, was an enormous gap. And he had a beard, and he was at university, and he was being groomed for greatness by family and school. And so to me, he was quite an intimidating figure. And I was very immature, 17-year-old. And Sally was certainly more mature. She was 5 months older, but she was a very vivacious, lively, but stable person and fun-loving, and that's what we loved about her. She wasn't a classical beauty. She wasn't sort of the stereotype of the private school porcelain doll. You know, she was very real. She swore and drank and smoked, and if you met her, you wouldn't think she was from that world at all. And that's why we were drawn to her, because we were trying to escape that world, you know, especially George. He was quite brave in what he stood up to, the grooming process that he was undergoing.
If someone played her in a movie, who would it be?
If Molly Ringwald were 18, that's who it would be.
Mm.
She looks quite a lot like Molly Ringwald was when she was young, yeah.
So there's a dream that George has. This is before she leaves. And so he tells her not to go, but obviously she does go, right?
Yeah.
She never mentioned it while in Europe that her boyfriend, her back home, her beau, had told her not to go, right?
That's right. She never told me, and I don't think anyone else as well.
Yeah. In terms of the letters that they exchanged, because they're marvelous in the sense that they show just how in love they were or infatuated they were with each other, and they're marvelous in how they show young people and how they communicate in that era.
Yes, it's archetypal, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's very powerful.
So he kept those letters and he gave them to you. Is that right?
That's right. When I visited him in 2010 in Vancouver, and we were sort of negotiating to go forward on this book. And as I describe it in the prologue, that's the opening scene of the book when I visit him. And I had a three-hour free-ranging conversation, and we were sort of giving it the green light. And in this dramatic moment, I'm leaving, and we pass a cardboard box full of these letters. And he takes the top one off the top, and he hands it to me. And he says, "This is the last letter Sally wrote me from Germany before she died, and it's too painful, I never opened it." And he gives it to me very dramatically. And I thought to myself, this is the opening scene of the book.
Mm.
And we, in fact, saved that letter for the end of the book. And then a few days later, he sent me the entire box of all the letters. And they form a kind of core of the book. And in the audio book, we have two young actors playing George and Sally reading the letters to each other. I just listened to it yesterday, and it's very powerful to listen to. A third actor plays my narrative voice, so there's three actors.
Yeah.
And, it's very much captures that time, for sure, 1968, and all the mayhem that was going on in the background in Europe and North America.
And so his own letters, how did he manage to keep those? Because he would have sent them to Europe.
They were in her luggage.
Oh, I see. And
yeah.
And that's how you got them back.
And her father, who was a doctor, brought them back, along with her gifts that she had bought for him. The poignant artifacts that he kept. And as I say in the book, he wrestled with that all of his life, because he's trying to shed the ghost and move on and love new women, and yet that's what the story is about a culture that, what shall we call it, a grief-phobic culture that we live in. And that was another reason I was drawn to the story, his World War II alcoholic parents and the generation gap of the 60s. And that is what is completely shocking. I mean, in some ways, his parents were certainly as bad as mine, but that they just could not handle this. That, you know, when he comes to tell them that Sally is dead, there's like literally no response.
Yeah.
They sit there and they stare at him. We're talking emotional eunuchs here.
Yeah, and it, It's a great sketch of the repressive culture that you all grew up in.
That's another reason I was drawn to it. That's the theme of my first two books as well.
Yeah.
I grew up in some ways worse than George, the repression. He sure as hell had a dose of it, but you know, the silence and the denial and the repression, the more British than the British, this upper Canadian curse, as George called it, one of the reasons he went to Vancouver, which saved his life, that he was being crushed by it. And we're similar in a lot of ways and we're different than others. For whatever reason, and it's not necessarily the right, better choice necessarily, but as he put it, I chose to stand and fight, you know, frontline battle with these forces. And then what I got out of it was the three books. But he got a new life, and now we're sort of meeting. Now we're meeting in the middle, the two of us.
There's a lesson in the book too about how to deal with grief, or perhaps I guess not, how not to, as you've just mentioned. But then you know when I think of Sally's death and how it's changed both of your lives, I guess it had to take 50 years for you both to understand
that's
it all.
That's right. And there's an analog to the culture at large. I mean, it's a microcosm of a story, but there's the macrocosm I was always trying to bring in as well, that in some sense you could argue 68 was the end of the 60s with all those assassinations and the loss, you know, the death of liberal idealism and King and the Kennedys and the bullets in the head, you know. And so Sally, in some ways, was a subtle reverberation of that. She died of a head wound, and it was sort of like the head wound of the 60s in a way that we all staggered out of it. And now, today, 50 years later, we're kind of reliving the same issues, aren't we? I mean, the idealism and the right-wing backlashes. I think at some level, the 60s, because of the sheer size of the boomer generation, and that happened so fast and so powerfully, it scared the hell out of the older people. And we have to clamp this one down, you know? And so, for me and George, I think Sally sort of represented hope. I mean, she was only 18, but... And in some ways, she was conventional. She at that time, she believed in house and family and kids and career, and she wanted to be a nurse. But we speculate about that, George and I, at the end of the book, like, who knows what might have happened, you know. The way he put it was, if she had gone radical, I would have gone with her, you know, because we were all changing at that time.
I asked him recently at lunch a week or so ago when I saw him. I've talked to him a couple times since I read the book. Since I first got the book, I should say, in the summertime, your publisher sent the galley, and the what if thing is something that I asked him about, and I'll ask him when he's on the show in a couple weeks about how that plays out in his head. But for you, I mean, is that something that, I mean, it is something that you have thought about over the last 50 years, hasn't it? What if she'd lived?
Yes, it's a fascinating thing, and he says in the book at one point to me, she was spared the nightmare of getting what she wanted, which is a rueful way of looking at it, but because of the baggage that we all had even before the tragedy, you know, that it's not easy, as you know, in the best of circumstances, you know, relationships and marriages and houses and all the rest of it, if that, you know, that conventional route. And I think George was deeply conflicted, as I was, about that it was, are we going to replicate our parents' values? This is the whole boomer generation split, isn't it? I mean, some people see the boomers as having sold out and not living up to their original ideals, but at the same time, we all can't be bohemians, you know?
Yeah.
But I think George and I wrestled with that all of our lives, and he, I think he says at one point in the book, I think he would have, because he says, I would have become a rigid, humorless boozer by my 40s and we would have divorced. You know, it's kind of like Ben and Elaine in The Graduate. What happens to them at the back of the bus and the last scene of The Graduate? We'd love to know, you know, did they make it? He tended to give it a thumbs down, actually. But who knows?
And in the course of writing this book, and not to mention your two previous books, because it has certainly affected your life, not just the subjects itself, you know, have formed your life, or shaped your life, I should say. The writing itself, has that changed your life? I mean, being able to write about the people around you, your past, I mean...
Enormously, yeah. I mean, there's a chapter I call Thera Journalism, mm-hmm. where that's what I think I was. I never really wanted to be a journalist like George. I really admire his frontline, tough-nosed journalist, which I wasn't. I was tended to hang back. And I think at some level I had a fantasy of being a writer, not a journalist, but certainly influenced by journalism. And so... Yeah, it's the writing for me is intensely difficult and painful, and yet it has brought me to where I am because, of, as you read in my book, I mean, for me, the deepest level of this was a mother book. My first two books were a father book, and this book is really about my mother's influence on me and her active interference in my romantic choices in life. When Sally died, she was just simply not there, like George's parents. I almost suspected she was glad she was dead. Hmm. It was a very bizarre thing. And so my writing process is trying to penetrate and confront my earliest years with my mother were disturbed, and she couldn't love me. She didn't pick me up or kiss me or hold me. It was that very, very cold wasp neglect, and for both me, my sister, and brother. And so, yes, that's what I dug up. That's the level to which I went when I was doing the book with George. That's where it sent me. And we challenged each other because we had similar mothers. I don't think his mother was as disturbed as mine, but they were similar. They were both private school educated. They were beautiful. They were intelligent, educated, but they lacked a maternal... or cut off from their maternal instincts.
They were ambitious women who, I guess, never fulfilled whatever potential they'd hoped for themselves.
That's the tragedy, yes, yeah. Because they were very capable and bright, and they could have run a company, both of them. They had some male energy, and this is, you know, pre-feminist 50s and 60s Toronto, and so they were very torn. Even though they had strong personalities, they couldn't use that strength to break through. Women were so isolated in those days, and the conformity and expectations and the role playing was so rigid, and you understand why their resentments built up against their husbands, their war traumatized husbands, and then they would reinvest their emotions in their firstborn sons. That would be George and me. So we had remarkably similar trajectories that way. So we had extremely absent fathers and intrusive mothers, which is again part of the baby boom legacy.
And where did that come from, do you think? Because I think one of you in the book says that there's a resentment there from them to your generation.
That's right. I mean, their resentment, our mother's resentment, was a huge factor in our attitudes, I think, because I think they bought into a romantic dream, didn't they? You know, that was the woman's role, was to bask in the glory of the husband. You know, my father was an accomplished doctor, and George's family came from his grandfather had founded an insurance company. So on the outside, it all looked great, mm-hmm. and seductive, and that's what Upper Canada College in that world is very good at, their image control and image burnishing from the outside. Outsiders looking in longingly at it is, you know, you've made it if you can penetrate that world. And all of my books are basically saying, stop and take a deeper look. You know.
He's got a great line in the book: the poor have one thing over the rich, at least they know when they've been loved for themselves.
I thought that was a brilliant remark. Yes, exactly right. That in that world, that's why the level of inauthentic and falseness, that it all looks great and everybody's everybody's friend, but this is the essence of the old boys network, is the reason we want to know you. Or David Thompson, the richest man in Canada, told me that even, you know,
yeah.
that you can't trust him. This is the paradox, that it's like Citizen Kane. You're isolated in your castle with your billions because you can never know for sure. It's very hard to tell if they actually appreciate you for who you are as a person, forget your wealth and influence and power. So that tends to define every human interaction you have. No wonder so many of them drink too much or suicide or have accidents. And that's what my first book unpacked, was
yeah.
the untold stories of, and I've known friends of mine who've succumbed to this, that they didn't, as they say in the 60s, follow their bliss or their true selves, and they became replicas of their fathers and went straight to Bay Street and became stockbrokers and then woke up when in their 40s or 50s and slapping their foreheads and, this is not my beautiful wife, this is not my beautiful house. And it's tragic. I've seen countless numbers as a journalist interviewing them, and untold numbers of these, and that's the tragedy. Then this has disappeared. This is not acknowledged. Yeah. It's denied. And this is going on today, still. I mean, it's remarkable. So, see, I am a, you would think at one level, the more enlightened aspect of the school, which it is. It's not a monolithic place. There are progressive, decent, intelligent people there.
Mm-hmm.
But their voices are drowned out, silenced, and that's the weapon they use. You know, you're ghosted, you're disappeared. This didn't happen. There is no book. These stories didn't happen. That's the very powerful forces you're dealing with.
So I'm
kind of persona non grata at the school. I mean, it was a huge sexual abuse scandal that erupted out of
right. All
of that stuff, and that, so it's a weird thing where it's a replication of my childhood, where my parents made me feel I didn't exist. Never responded to me. I don't even know why they had children. And same with the school. And so I'm recognized, certainly, and respected outside that world, which is a wonderful thing, but there will always be these two bubbles. And in some ways it must be that way, and I'm certainly comfortable with it. I wouldn't want to be reaccepted into that world. It wouldn't make any sense. But I can talk to people like you and feel real.
And I think that's the gift of your book, is that it'll be helpful for a lot of people. Now, the one thing that I was wondering, because this obviously is not the way I grew up, the people that you do write about, how have they reacted to the book?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, because in some ways it's a challenge, isn't it? It certainly requires bravery to wade into these issues, and some people respond magnificently and come along, and others, of course, don't, and that's okay, too, and that's the original risk I took with George, you know, that are we prepared to face these things? Like, you can't force people to face their past and their ghosts and their baggage, but it's certainly an invitation, isn't it, you know, and it's sort of, the book is kind of a, not exactly a manual, but here's how we tried, and it's exploring the limits of it, I guess. It's like, it's never going to be perfection, and you're going to upset people. This is what journalists and artists do, isn't it? We upset the apple cart, and we challenge baseline assumptions, and the assumption is that this is ultimately healthy for the society and the person, even though it's difficult.
And so for you, the writing, not just this book, but the two previous ones, I mean, that has been healthy for you, and you have made peace with what you've had to make?
There's no question. In my own case,
yeah.
I made the right decision, because I was able to sort of fight out of this ultimately psychotic isolation that killed my father and grandfather. That was such the cautionary tale, watching what happened to them, and they succumbed to this, both of them brilliant doctors, but that macho male privileged world where you're not supposed to admit to an iota of vulnerability. This is a real man doesn't admit to this. And then the 60s came along and at least gave some degree of permission that it's okay to do that. And that's what I think saved my life, that I was able to reach out and interact with others and get help and broaden myself. And, you know, I don't know. If the 60s hadn't happened, I really think I'd be dead. You know, I think I would have followed suit into the family drama and that dark path that was bequeathed to me. And so it is a kind of turnaround story, no question, in my case. And writing was a key part of this.
Yeah.
Now I think I got over-invested in writing. I wish I had branched out into other art, you know, fields of art like filmmaking or acting. But I got obsessed with writing as the tool to dig myself out of this hole. And I'm kind of exhausted now. I've got to tell you, after three books, I think I am. I think I've said it all that I need to say at this point.
There's a line in the book. The end of the book, you write a letter to Sally yourself.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful in many parts. But there's a line in there where you tell Sally that you once thought that writing a book would finish her off for you.
Yes.
And you say, I have merely finished myself off as a book writer. So I'm wondering, you talked a moment ago about being exhausted. But you're still a writer. Will you write again?
I think I will do short form stuff, maybe essays, and I think the next period book was just appeared a couple of weeks ago, and so this is a very exciting period of talking to people like you and wonderful conversations. But this is what I think I really want, ultimately, the deepest level. This was an epiphany for me during the book, that why was I a slave to the written word, and it has a lot to do with my mother. And even though I've got good at it, the rewards, it was sort of a law of diminishing returns for me emotionally. And the publication of the book is the really rewarding part, and the responses to it. Because I got no responses as a child.
Mm.
I can't overstate the power of this, being left alone for hours and hours in a room alone, imploding on myself and my own inner imagination. And this is what turned me into a writer. I was writing my mother's stories at six, you know. And so it's the oral culture, the speaking. Radio has always attracted me, as it has George. And that this is my ultimate healing for myself and the rest of my life, I think, that this is being able to do. This is a privilege, what we're doing right now, I find, this part of it, to be able to kick this stuff around with another person and a sensitive reader. That's a privilege. And I would love to do, and there are some, this fall, there's a bunch of dates for me lined up for this, so I'm really looking forward to that and where that will take George and I. And when I come out to the West Coast, George and I, who knows what may happen, but we're starting to fantasize about some kind of taking it on the road as a duet, you know?
Yeah.
And that he said back and forth, and that the conversation continues, and opening up the conversations, the levels of issues that are embedded in this are so rich. And so it's just the question of what kind of forums will become available to us and what this can open up potentially, maybe even a film, who knows.
Yeah.
But that's what's exciting to me. And that's what I mean about dropping writing.
Right.
But therefore I'm not as invested in writing another book. But I'll never say never. I mean, I have a filing cabinet full of personal experiences of synchronicity. I become fascinated with that concept.
Yeah, and that's the other fascinating thing about in the book, is that there's so many eerie, spooky moments.
Coincidences.
Yeah, and we haven't touched on it because I think people should read the book for that, because it'll make for such an exciting and enjoyable read. But if you had to tell people about, say, these coincidences, not only about you and George and other things that you write about in the book, things that happen. I mean, your life seems to have been filled with them, but I guess when I think about it, all our lives are. We just need to say think about it or notice it, right?
Yes, that's right. I think because I'm an artist and a writer and a journalist, so therefore it's almost my full-time job to notice them.
Mm.
That's what I do. I'm aware of them, and I maybe even generate them unconsciously. That's one of the theories it is a phenomenon of the unconscious mind. And as Freud said, the return of the repressed. He said there's a whole fascinating literature on what the uncanny is and what the mechanisms of the mind that produce it. And it's a fascinating subject. That yes, and in fact, that could be a fourth book down the road, more like a less personal book, but just kind of a long lecture and gathering of all them. I read 30 or 40 books on the subject. It was fascinating as a kind of sidebar. And in fact, my editor, I did write a chapter called Synchro Swimming, where I was trying to introduce that into the Sally narrative, but it was too third person and too impersonal and too abstract. It didn't really fit the power, the emotional power of the story. We quite rightly took it out. But I got diverted down that path simply because it's happened to me much more than George. I mean, George's dream in some way was a one-off.
Yeah.
I asked him, does this happen to you a lot? And he said, no, that was just the most powerful one of his life. But mine have started to pick up speed during the book, and especially now. I've had three or four just in the last 2 months that are mind blowers, and that I will speak about at some point that are remarkable. And the danger, as you know, I think part of the reason people don't speak speak about these things because in our rational, materialist, scientific world, we risk being mocked.
Mm.
And, oh, he's a little nuts, he's a little New Agey. And, you know, I'm not trying to sell it as a certainty. It's just a fascinating phenomenon. Just be open-minded. It's a phenomenon, that's all.
Yeah.
And we've all experienced deja vus and these quirky things, but to dismiss it brusquely and out of hand strikes me as strange. It seems to suggest people are afraid of it.
Yeah, and it is cruel, I think, because I think because when one reads your book, Dreaming Sally, and sees these things that happen, not only in your life and George's and so forth,
yes.
It robs the meaning of it all.
That's right, and that's what it's for. It's a kind of poetry. It gives meaning and purpose and pattern to the life. And what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
You know, we face the kind of nihilistic despair in so much of North American society, and all of the
yeah.
pathology and the drinking has a lot to do with this, and the receding of traditional religion, and so it's a that's the way I treat it, and. I think, as I say, it wasn't just George. As you may remember, his best friend Stuart had an incredibly powerful psychic experience the day of Sally's death. He was in Ireland. He had introduced Sally to George 2 years earlier. And out of the blue, he's overcome with this powerful feeling.
And has to call him, right?
That something terrible has happened to George in Toronto, and I have to get on the plane. He doesn't even call him. He gets on the plane.
Yeah,
he just obeys this. He's sort of the hero of the book in some ways because he was sort of a 60s archetype, a guy who's in touch with himself and his body, was intuitive. And they backtracked and found out that he had that premonition on August 13th, right around the time Sally died. And it's remarkable.
Yeah.
And he came in Toronto immediately to take care of George. And George says, to this day, my friend Stuart saved his life because he was heading into a suicidal spiral right after her death. Because of the lack of support.
Mm.
That's what was so shocking. You know, this is, again, a tribute to the boomer generation, because we invested so much in our peer group because the parents were nowhere to be found. And Stuart represents that spirit, that he loved his soul brother. There was no question about it. You know, this isn't an issue. You know, here's my friend in hell, and I will do everything I can to help him because I love him. It was real simple. But his parents were incapable of that. And that was true of my family, too. My father and grandfather fell into hell, and no one could go down and extend a hand. It's a sickness that, you know, I've been trying to understand my whole life.
And you and George are good friends now.
Yes,
bond,
we earned it.
Yeah. This bond that you have, could you describe that for us?
The
bond that you both have?
Yes. That, as I say, we earned it. It was a slow, interesting, slightly rocky, but really powerful evolution because he estimates we spent about 200 hours talking over several years, mostly on the phone, but whenever he was in Toronto, he came over and we would talk further face to face, and I would scribble down notes. And as you know, he's a very articulate guy and a wordsmith himself, and from the broadcast side. And so a lot of the chapters that describe George are in his voice. It's his language, not mine.
Uh-huh.
A lot of that stuff, I had to weave it into my sentence making, but so many of those vivid, evocative phrases in the George chapters, especially his childhood, are straight out of his mouth. And I said, I don't want to co-opt here. It's like cultural appropriation. That would you like to write your own chapter? You know, alternately through the book. And he didn't want to do that because part of the tension of the story was, here's a master storyteller, George Orr, but the mother of all stories, which is Sally, he couldn't do it because of the emotional pain of it. And so I'm kind of like his amanuensis coming in and the midwife, and we're trying to tell the story together. And I think he really stuck to that. And I was almost trying to pull him off of it and saying, get me off the hook. Why don't you write your end and I'll write mine? But he insisted that I be the narrator throughout. And so fascinating things came out of that. And as you know him, he's a very honest person, which I really appreciate. And so he would report to me as we went on year by year how he was feeling at any given moment. And he might be happy, or he might be pissed off or irritated, or he, and if he did say, for example, that he was upset or stirred up, and he suddenly became my father, and I felt I had to fix it, or you know, or it's okay, George, we can quit, we don't have to do this book, and try to get into a bit of a protection racket. And he would always correct me and say, James, I signed up for this, you know, doesn't mean I want you to quit, I'm just telling you how I feel, and you don't have to do anything about it. Which was my early drama, that I had to cater to all of these difficult people. And that was a wonderful kind of bridge that we crossed together. And so a mutual respect started to build, and we understood what we were, how we were fundamentally challenging each other, and to go deeper and deeper, as deeply as we could go, and in the service of truth-telling, which is, you know, as you know, he spent a career of, you know, among other things, chasing lying politicians. And so he didn't. He wanted to be as transparent as he could himself, be an open book, and set an example for that, you know.
You've captured,
it was a great thing to do.
You've captured him so well, because, I mean, I've heard some of these stories in the past, and, you know, I've known him for a few years now, and one forgets sometimes. And so I reread some anecdote that's in your book, and I'm reminded of the time I heard it the first time, and it's his voice. And
yes.
And you write in the back of the book that in a way he was a co-author, wasn't he?
That's exactly correct. Yeah. I know it's filled with paradox, because I know he was fascinated with book writing and publishing and wanted to be included in it all. But I think maybe what was going on was he was just respecting my authorial voice, and, you know, that trusting me to do that, because a great deal of trust is involved here. It's easy to botch this and get it wrong and screw it up and misrepresent him. And he didn't. I invited him to read the manuscript and correct anything, and, you know, but he didn't really. I sent it to him, the first draft, I guess, 2 years ago, and he didn't. What was happening was, I think, that he was still having trouble processing the power of what we were doing, as I was too. And so there was very little, if none almost, interference in the process. He was trusting, it's your book, it's your writing, go with it. It's your point of view. It doesn't mean it's the truth. It's a truth. And I respect that, which is a quite magnanimous thing.
Yeah.
You know? And as I say, I think it's also evolving because of what's now happening right now, and then coming out west in the fall, and where this takes the two of us next, you know, into the unknowable future. That's what's really interesting. In some ways, we're just starting a new phase.
Yeah.
And what is possible, because he was the broadcast journalist and I was the print journalist, right?
Yeah.
And so these two modalities, he's highly adept at this, and I'm still learning. I'm getting much better at it. I used to be terrified of public speaking in 2010 when my last book came out. It thrust me out there, and I learned on my feet, and it was a wonderful experience to speak in front of a live audience and have responses to your work. It's very, very powerful. And so I'm much, much more comfortable with that. It's getting to where George has always been comfortable with it. He was from the beginning. And you know, that's what's so shocking, isn't it, that his parents, here he is, a 10-year-old boy, all he wants from the beginning is to be a journalist. He wants to be that guy on the radio. He loves it.
Mm-hmm. He'd sneak out, right, and
right.
watch people do a radio show.
Yeah, it was in his blood from the beginning. This is what gave him joy. And they crushed it in him. And he goes to them, and he's hating his school and the grooming. They wanted to turn him into a prime minister because he's brilliant. He doesn't want to be prime minister. He wants to be a radio guy. And this is like was saying in 1964, this was the equivalent of saying to his parents that he wanted to be a drug dealer or something. And that he wanted to go to disreputable Ryerson Polytechnic to become a journalist. And they almost disowned him on the spot. It was crushing. And then Sally's death on the heels of this. This is trauma, you know, with the twin towers of our lives, our work and love, and if those are kind of, you know, been assassinated by the time you're a teenager or a 20-year-old, I mean, it's a tribute to his resilience that didn't kill him, actually.
Yeah.
You know, and he, but he had this critical help from his friend Stuart. And so that's partly of our parallel lives, the what-ifs, that if we hadn't had these magical interventions in both of our lives and help and men reaching out and learning to be more comfortable with their vulnerability, that these are the stakes that, that, you know, you can end up killing yourself literally or metaphorically, or, you know, like drink yourself to death slowly, or that's a kind of suicide, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to actually jump off a bridge, but that's what I've seen, and you're hoping that the culture, the paradigm, you're starting to see signs of it now, thank God, the women's movement, and, you know. If you read recently, a columnist in the Toronto Sun mocked Justin Trudeau
for crying
mm-hmm. at his father's funeral.
Yeah.
This is out of the 19th century. I mean, I don't know if it's a cynical remark, if he actually believes it, but there we go, there it is.
Yeah. So you don't have to jump off a bridge, but you do take a leap when you write a book like this.
That's right.
Your publisher initially wanted me to talk to you and George together, I thought it'd be a good idea. But it's such a rich book that I thought I should do a segment with you and then one with George, because there's just so much I want to talk about, and I so appreciate your time today, and I look forward when you're out here later in the fall to meeting you.
I would love that, and maybe that will be possible, the three of us do it in some forum.
Indeed.
You'd be perfect for it, I think, yeah.
And so the other thing is, we're talking in early September, and I understand George will be out there in Toronto shortly.
Just tomorrow, actually. Yep.
Yeah, and so you'll be meeting with a number of members of the folks that went on this trip.
The Odyssey,
right?
As it was called, yes. We're going to have a reunion the following night, our 50th reunion here at my home, and there'll be about 18 of the original 20 surviving 27 are coming from Halifax and Vancouver and Toronto, so it's going to be quite the party.
I'm 36, James, and so I'm wondering, these friends of yours, these people from your past, I mean, this is a bond that's inextricable. And I guess this sort of friendship only happens when you're that age, right?
That's right. The power of that time, as you know, when we're 18 and full of hormones, we're intensely alive, aren't we, at that age? And the first love is, we've all had that experience, that intense early experience, that we never forget, though.
Yeah.
And this story is all the more powerful, is that he had that experience and then it was killed so dramatically and abruptly, which is not what everybody experiences, but killed in this uncanny way that it's like his gift, whatever gift George has, that at some level he sensed it, or we don't know, this is the mystery, it's not as if he necessarily knew this precognitively, but... I do explore that theme in the book,
yeah.
about what might have been going on there in terms of what the dream means and what he was trying to... His terror of losing her is a very powerful part of the story, and why? What are the roots of that?
Yeah, I look forward to talking to him about this book shortly, but until then, I could talk all day with you. This has been such fun to speak with you about your book, because, it, as I said... earlier, it's a beautiful book in many parts, and it's a hell of an achievement. Congratulations, James, on it, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you, Joe. Really appreciate it.
Visit jamesfitzgerald.ca for more. The book is called Dreaming Sally, A True Story of First Love, Sudden Death, and Long Shadows. It's published by Random House. Also, not to forget the event on the 20th of November, Tuesday, 7 p.m. at Massey Books here in Vancouver. James Fitzgerald joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.